KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Overall, we're expecting to see prices for metals going up by about 33%, which is a very high increase.
A new 50% tariff on steel and aluminum will raise prices on everything from cars to canned soup.
It's Wednesday, June 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, the defense secretary plans to rename a ship named after gay rights icon Harvey Milk.
Also, a new health advisory highlights how artificial intelligence can harm kids' mental health.
You can use AI to generate text or images in ways that are incredibly inappropriate for kids. It can be used to promote cyberbullying.
And New Zealand's former prime minister describes how she got her country to pass strict gun legislation in response to a mass shooting.
Crisis calls for change, and it keeps calling for it until it happens.
Plus, why the state of Maryland loves Orange Crush.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump has announced he is again barring people from countries the administration deems dangerous from coming to the U.S. The ban takes effect Monday. Speaking at the White House, Trump pointing to a recent terror attack allegedly carried out by an Egyptian national as the reason for his move.
Very simply, we cannot have open migration from any country where we cannot safely and reliably vet and screen those who seek to enter the United States. That is why today I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
The latest ban is similar to one instituted during Trump's first term that caused confusion at airports after legal challenges. That order was retooled until the version was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2018. The White House is disputing estimates from the Congressional Budget Office. The president's big tax and spending cuts bill will add trillions of dollars to the national deficit. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, it comes as Elon Musk is posting on social media the bill should be killed.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates the bill would add $2.4 trillion to the nation's deficit over the next decade. But White House Budget Director Russell Vogt, in a call with reporters, disputed the CBO's calculation.
It will improve the deficit. It will help us deal with debt. It is historic levels of mandatory savings. The fact that the Congressional Budget Office doesn't agree is not particularly new.
As for Musk, who has called for members of Congress to be voted out of office if they support the bill, Vogt said he isn't worried about opposing views from the outside. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Closing arguments have ended in the sex crimes retrial of former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Ilya Marritz from New York says the trial, now in its 8 weeks, is nearing its conclusion.
In her summation, prosecutor Nicole Blumberg said Harvey Weinstein wouldn't take no for an answer from any of the three women who accused him from the witness box. Blumberg frequently used the word rape and said the jurors should believe the women because they testified of their own free will and had nothing to gain. Weinstein, who did not testify, expressed confidence he would be acquitted in an interview with the Daily Mail, which appeared Wednesday, saying, quote, "I think there's a real movement now to telling the truth and proving that these girls were in it for the money." Next, the jury will receive instructions from the judge and begin its deliberations. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Marritz in New York.
Smoke from Canadian wildfires is again darkening the skies over parts of the U.S., creating unhealthy air conditions in parts of the eastern U.S. and several midwestern states. Wildfires have already forced thousands of Canadians to flee their homes, sending smoke plumes downwind into the U.S. Canadian wildfires also caused problems in terms of smoke in the U.S. last year. On Wall Street, the Dow dropped 91 points. This is NPR. Gaza food aid for the moment is put on hold by an Israeli and U.S.-backed group. That's after health officials say dozens of Palestinians were killed in a series of shootings near distribution sites this week. Separately, officials say the strikes across the territory killed 26 people overnight and into today. Gaza health officials, the Red Cross, and the U.N. Rights Office says 27 people were killed yesterday. Discount retailer Dollar Tree, which imports many of its products from China, says tariffs are cutting into its profits. In an earnings call, the company projected second quarter profits will be half what they were a year ago. Stephen Bershahov, the Gulf States Newsroom, has more.
Dollar Tree estimates the tariffs will cost the company about $200 million this fiscal year. A lot of that is due to the rate the company paid on products it imported from China in April and May, when the trade war was at its hottest. Here's Dollar Tree CFO Stuart Glendinning during that earnings call.
There was a big impact in the second quarter from those few weeks of 145% tariff. That money really adds up at that rate.
Long-term, Dollar Tree is optimistic. Glendinning predicted the retailer would more than make up for those losses in the second half of the year. But that's assuming tariffs stay where they are and don't go any higher. Glendinning added that the cost of tariffs is just complicated to calculate. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha.
Crude oil futures prices, after moving higher briefly, turned in the other direction later in the day. Oil prices falling after new numbers showed a large buildup of gas and diesel inventories. Oil dropped 56 cents a barrel to $62.85 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Imported steel and aluminum just got a whole lot more expensive. President Trump's 50% tariffs on the metals kicked in today, doubling what they were just yesterday. Trump told steelworkers last week his goal is to secure the steel industry in the United States.
With the help of patriots like you, we're going to produce our own metal, unleash our own energy, secure our own future, build our country, control our destiny, and we are once again going to put Pennsylvania steel into the backbone of America like never before.
So what do these higher taxes on metal mean for consumers? Martha Gimbel at Yale's Budget Lab has been running the numbers. She previously worked for the Biden administration. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about one of the biggest purchases people make, cars. How will doubling tariffs on imported steel and aluminum affect car buyers?
Yeah, so we're now expecting car prices to go up by about 13% in the short run.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty big hit for people. And cars are already an incredibly expensive purchase. So 13%, that's real money.
Does it matter if we're talking about domestic or imported cars?
So we're expecting domestic producers to raise their prices. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is, they are takers of steel, right? Like, they need that for making their cars. The other thing is that when you see domestic producers competing with foreign producers who have to raise their prices because of tariffs, as a domestic producer, why would you not raise your prices in response as well? And so you're going to see some price matching from domestic producers in response to the new environment.
What about car parts? Are those prices also going up?
They're also going up about the same amount. So there's really, even if you're saying, okay, well, I'm just going to take my old car, keep it on the road for a while, do some repairs, those repairs are also going to cost you more.
There's a lot of metal on store shelves, whether it's soft drinks, tomato sauce, soup, canned goods. How are the higher metal tariffs likely to affect prices on groceries?
So it's hard to say overall, because you need to know exactly how much steel is exactly in your can of soup. Mm-hmm. But overall, we're expecting to see prices for metals going up by about 33%, which, again, is a very high increase.
Yeah, and I'm thinking store shelves are made of metal. And so is the price of stuff you buy in the store going to go up because the price of the things that make up the store infrastructure has gone up?
I hadn't even been thinking about that. But I think it really speaks to the way tariffs just sneak into parts of our lives that we aren't even thinking about. You know, who amongst us is thinking about the cost of store shelves? All of a sudden, it becomes relevant.
While we're on the topic of higher prices, the discount retailer Dollar General announced this week that their sales are up compared to the same period last year, and they're forecasting better sales for the rest of the year than previously. What do you make of that news?
Yeah, it's never a good sign when places like Dollar General are doing really, really well, except, of course, for the people who are involved with Dollar General. It seems like what is happening is that consumers are shifting to, or starting to shift to, lower priced goods because of the price pressures that they're feeling. So that's good news for Dollar General, but not necessarily good news for the overall economy.
To expand beyond the metal tariffs, if these numbers remain in place, and of course there is no guarantee that they will, how will that affect the average household budget in America, according to your calculations?
Yeah, so we're expecting to see increased costs of about $2,500 per household. You know, that obviously is a really substantial cost increase for people to be facing. It's even higher for those as a percentage of income for people at the bottom of the income distribution. That's because they tend to spend more on goods, and it just makes it harder for them to absorb these price increases.
Does that assume that the cost of the tariffs will all be passed along to the consumer, or could it be that some of these retailers absorb the cost themselves?
You know, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not people are going to absorb the cost themselves. Historically, that has not happened. And so you can look at the first set of Trump tariffs and how much that has been passed on to consumers. And you'll see economists arguing, you know, was it 97% passed on? Was it 99% passed on? Was it 100% passed on? That's a fun debate for us to have. But for the American consumer, it basically means the same thing. They're going to be paying these tariffs.
Martha Gimbel is the executive director of the Budget Lab at Yale. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
A new health advisory calls on developers of artificial intelligence and educators to do more to protect young people from manipulation and exploitation. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
Systems using artificial intelligence are already pervasive in our increasingly digital lives.
It's the part of your email application that finishes a sentence for you or spell checks.
Mitch Prinstein is chief of psychology at the American Psychological Association and one of the authors of the new report.
It's embedded in social media, where it tells you what to watch and what friends to have and what order you should see your friends' posts.
It's not that AI is all bad.
It can really be a great way to help start a project, to brainstorm, to get some feedback.
But teens and young adults' brains aren't fully developed, he says, making them especially vulnerable to the pitfalls of AI.
We're seeing that kids are getting information from AI that they believe when it's not true, and they're developing relationships with bots on AI, and that's potentially interfering with their real-life human relationships in ways that we got to be careful about.
Prinstein says there are reports of kids being driven to violence and even suicidal behavior by bots. And AI is putting young people at a greater risk of harassment.
You can use AI to generate text or images in ways that are incredibly inappropriate for kids. It can be used to promote cyberbullying.
That's why the new advisory from the American Psychological Association recommends that AI tools should be designed to be developmentally appropriate for young people.
Have we thought about the ways that kids' brains are developing or their relationship skills are developing to keep kids safe, especially if they're getting exposed to really inappropriate material or potentially predators?
For example, building in periodic notifications into AI tools that remind young people they're interacting with a bot, or suggestions encouraging them to seek out real human interactions. Prinstein says that educators can help protect youth from harms of AI. He says schools are just waking up to the harms of social media on kids' mental health.
And we're a little bit playing catch up. I think it's really important for us to remember that we have the power to change this now before AI goes a little bit too far and we find ourselves playing catch up again.
Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
For decades, Orange Crushes have been Marylanders' go-to cocktail on beach trips and sweaty nights. Now, Maryland has declared the vodka-based drink its official state cocktail. Scott Massioni from member station WIPR takes it from here.
On a warm afternoon in late May, just feet away from the Baltimore Orioles ballpark, hundreds of people pack into Pickles Pub. There's a beer garden with a hollowed-out school bus, and at the indoor bar, the walls are painted dill pickle green and decked out in baseball memorabilia. But still, it's not hard to spot Maryland's new state cocktail. The Orange Crush is known for its distinctive orange tint, and Pickle's customers can get their fill with a whopping 32-ounce servings of the drink.
I would say 5 years ago that we were a beer bar.
Tom Leonard's a co-owner of the bar.
And we are a crush pub 100% now. I mean, it's like the number one thing is the Orange Crush. But yeah, it's taken off. It is the drink.
For those uninitiated into the nuances of Maryland cuisine, crushes consist of lots of ice, vodka, triple sec, Sprite, and of course, fresh squeezed oranges.
If you don't have the fresh squeezed juice, it's not even worth it.
Jessica Sullivan's a bartender at Pickles, who's serving orange crushes today.
They're definitely just like a light summer drink that's like an easy drinker. It doesn't taste too much like alcohol. They go down nice and easy. Not too sweet, not too fruity. They're definitely become everybody's favorite drink that comes around here, for sure.
She's pouring up 6 to 7 crushes at one time to keep up with the packed sports fans, 2 or 3 deep at the bar. Roland Joyce is slaking his thirst with the crush.
Orange juice is like a great drink that everyone loves, and then you can give a little twist to it.
He says Maryland's known for a handful of alcoholic beverages. National Bohemian Beer or Natty Bo's on tap everywhere you look. Oyster Shooters are abound, and Clamato's with Old Bay rims are constantly on special. But Joyce says the crush deserves the limelight. Or the orange light, in this case.
Love Old Bay, but I think it's time for the crush to shine.
And Maryland state legislators agree. They, along with Governor Wes Moore, passed a law designating the drink the state cocktail. On a typical Friday, Pickles goes through more than 5,600 oranges, and about 4 to 5 oranges go into each 32-ounce drink. Over at one of the tables, Elizabeth McPherson and Faith Weston are sipping on their crushes. McPherson's from Maryland and says all her friends have to try a crush before an Orioles game.
They're so good. They're so refreshing. They're summer. They're what I think of for summer in Maryland.
She's treating Weston to her first crush.
Well, I am not a vodka drinker. This has a lot of vodka in it, but it doesn't taste bad. Would I order it again outside of a baseball game? Probably not. But it's not bad.
And just like in baseball, you can't win them all. But personally, I can attest after just a sip, Maryland State Cocktail is here to stay. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Jacinda Ardern led New Zealand through crisis after crisis in the 5 years she served as prime minister. There was the COVID pandemic, a volcanic eruption, but it was the mass shootings in Christchurch that cemented her global reputation as a capable and empathetic leader. Ardern writes about that moment in 2019 in her new memoir, A Different Kind of Power.
It was meant to be a relatively uneventful day. I was on my way to visit a new build of a school out in a rural part of New Zealand when my press secretary handed me the phone and said there's been a shooting.
Actually, two shootings. A single gunman opened fire in two separate mosques during Friday prayers, live streaming one of the shootings on Facebook.
We know that the moment he arrived at the first mosque in order to undertake his attack, he was welcomed by a member of the community who opened the door and said, "Welcome, brother." And he was shot dead.
It was the worst mass shooting in the country's history.
And when did it become clear, as awful as 1, 2, 3 deaths would have been, that this was going to be something of a much bigger scale?
It unfolded over the course of the day.
Yeah.
Very quickly, we became aware of the scale. And by the time I exited the police station and went to a hotel in order to give a briefing, that was the first moment I saw images and I could see the ambulances arriving.
Many ambulances. 51 people were killed. 51. And Jacinda Ardern, the youngest woman ever elected to lead a country, decided it was time to change New Zealand's gun laws. When I sat down with Ardern this week in our New York bureau, I asked, how'd she do it?
I remember the day after the attack, the police commissioner confirming for us that the weapons, as far as they could tell at that stage, had been legally acquired. Mm-hmm. And it felt like being punched in the stomach because there was...
We let this happen.
Yeah, there was an air of, you know, the moment your laws create a permission space, you feel complicit almost in a way. You certainly... I mean, I already felt a responsibility to respond, but in that moment, there was, you know, it sat squarely with us. So I went to a press conference immediately after and said that our gun laws needed to change. And then it was a matter of working through how and what that would look like. And here I have to really credit John Howard, an Australian Prime Minister who predated me, a Conservative Prime Minister who had his own experience and Australia's own experience with mass gun violence and what something was called the Port Arthur Massacre. And after that, they changed their gun laws by removing access to military-style and semi-automatic weapons, and they coupled it with a buyback. So we had a model.
You thought, why reinvent the wheel?
Why reinvent
the
wheel?
They did it. It worked.
Okay. It enabled us to move quickly. And so we introduced law and took 10 days to debate it and pass it. In all, 27 days roughly after the attack, we had moved to ban semi-automatic and military-style weapons in New Zealand.
So you and I are sitting talking in the United States of America, where there is a constitutional right to keep and bear arms, the Second Amendment.
Mm.
Does any piece of the New Zealand experience apply here?
To the extent that anyone else within the United States believes it does. My, you know, experience simply is that empathetic leadership is not just about being there in the moment and experiencing and understanding as much as anyone is able when you're not directly a victim yourself what is happening for people. It's also about action. And I do think crisis calls for change, and it keeps calling for it until it happens.
So understanding that you are reluctant to give advice to any other country on how they should do it, because it's a different situation and a different culture with different laws. However, I am going to ask, do you have any advice for your counterparts here, for America's political leaders who are horrified when they see gun violence here and yet have sworn an oath to uphold our Constitution?
Well, here I would say my observation, and keeping in mind that I wouldn't say I'd be alone in politics in this view, because every member of parliament at the time in New Zealand, bar one, voted for this law change. And I would say, not to speak on their behalf, that within the thinking of most legislators at that time, it would have been, yes, New Zealand has a relatively high number of guns and gun ownership because, of course, we have a real pragmatic issue. We're farmers, we're food producers, we have pests, we have goats, we have possums, we have deer. AR-15s are designed to kill people, and they're designed to kill people at a rate that is just beyond comprehension. And so in our minds, there was a differentiation to be made between the idea of simply gun ownership and the type of gun. And so we made that differentiation.
Jacinda Ardern, you use the word kindness so many times I lost track in this book. You make it the centerpiece of your book because it was the centerpiece. It was your guiding principle in leadership.
Yes.
You have a great line, kindness has a power and strength that almost nothing else on this planet has. Why center that of all of the different values you could have been striding toward as prime minister? Why that one?
I think it's been missing. And I think there's also an unfair assumption that doesn't really exist or belong in leadership, but particularly politics, because it's so often associated with the idea of weakness. That in order to be in politics, you have to have a level of strength and resilience, and that in and of itself, that is incompatible with kindness and empathy. And I disagree. I disagree, particularly in these times where there's so much dehumanization. And dehumanization leads to aggression, to violence, and ultimately does nothing to solve the problems that so many of our communities are facing.
I mean, you're describing a leadership style that is centered on kindness and empathy and compassion.
Yes.
Apply that to America's political leaders today.
I don't know that for the listener that I would need to. I mean, obviously, for me, it's not just about any one country. There are two different styles of leadership that we're seeing globally. And I tend not to focus on individuals because I don't think they are a singular example. I think actually this is a broader issue. We have the world over examples of those who utilize in politics the weapons of fear and blame. And it's a tool that's been used for a very long time. It's not new. Versus the more difficult task of what are really complex issues, and in this current time, I'd say, which are deeply rooted in ideas of financial insecurity, rapid change, and generally a sense that the world is changing around us and we can't guarantee the kind of life that our kids will inherit.
Jacinda Ardern was the 40th Prime Minister of New Zealand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Her new memoir is A Different Kind of Power. And you can watch our full interview on youtube.com/NPR.
This is NPR News.
The United States is cracking down on international students, and fewer international students seem interested in paying American universities to attend. So where would they go instead?
In the short term, the UK will undoubtedly benefit, but in the long term, the cause of global research may very well suffer.
Why students may flock to Britain, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A year after Russian dissident Alexei Navalny died in a Siberian prison, his widow's launching a satellite news channel broadcasting into Russia.
It brings the Navalny Group's great content, which is incredibly popular, to the Russian-speaking broadcast audience.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump spoke with Russia's Vladimir Putin by phone for more than an hour today about Ukraine's recent strikes on Russian aircraft, but Trump said nothing about Putin's vow to retaliate against the attacks by Ukraine on its airfields. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Zelensky repeated his call for face-to-face talks with Putin. Zelensky says his country needs more air defenses and weapons to push Moscow toward real peace talks.
From him, we can't wait for his initiative moving to peace. We just have to pressure on him, and maybe we will get peace.
Russian and Ukrainian leaders met recently in Turkey about a ceasefire, but attacks on both sides have intensified since. U.S. officials say they were disappointed but not surprised about the list of demands today from Putin before he agrees to a 30-day ceasefire. The U.S. Education Department calling into question Columbia University's accreditation. It's the latest escalation between the Trump administration and elite colleges. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny has the story.
The Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights sent a notice to the accrediting body that audits Columbia University, saying the school is in violation of anti-discrimination laws and therefore fails to meet standards for accreditation. The findings stem from an investigation from February looking into whether the school adequately protected Jewish students on campus. The commission that accredits the school can revoke the university's eligibility for federal funding if it deems that Columbia is not in compliance. In a statement, a Columbia University spokesperson said the school takes the issue of anti-Semitism seriously and is working with the federal government to address it. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today after a pair of weaker-than-expected reports on the economy, raising concerns about inflation. This is NPR. There's a new number one song in America, and it's by a fresh face, as we hear from NPR's Stephen Thompson.
This year, familiar stars like Kendrick Lamar, SZA, and Morgan Wallen have dominated the top of the Billboard charts. But on the Hot 100 singles chart, there's a new name at number one. After a four-month rise, Alex Warren has finally topped the chart with Ordinary. With its mix of soaring pop and signifiers of praise music, the uplifting love song tops the chart just in time for the height of wedding season. Ordinary had to leapfrog three songs by country star Morgan Wallen in order to hit number one. Wallen's new record, I'm the Problem, tops the album chart for a second straight week. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
As Republicans push to get President Trump's big tax and spending bill approved, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says it would leave millions of Americans without health insurance over the next decade. The analysis by the CBO says extending the 2017 tax cuts passed during the first Trump administration would leave nearly 11 million people with no health insurance, while adding nearly $3 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. Even former Doge advisor Elon Musk criticized the spending package, urging Republicans to kill the bill. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Pentagon is calling for a ship named for the late Navy veteran and gay rights advocate Harvey Milk to be changed. And that same fate could also be in store for seven other ships named after civil rights leaders, as well as prominent women. This is the latest in the Trump administration's efforts to reverse what they call a woke military, focusing too much on diversity, equity, and inclusion. NPR's Tom Bowman is here in the studio with more. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, do we know when the ship will be renamed, and what can you tell us about the others?
You know, we don't. Now, this ship, it's basically a supply ship named for Harvey Milk, has been in the fleet for the past 2 years. The other seven are in various stages of construction and named for the likes of Harriet Tubman, a former slave who helped slaves escape to freedom, also Cesar Chavez, the Hispanic labor activist. All these ships named are being reviewed. This was first reported, by the way, by CBS News. Now, these are all part of the John Lewis class of ships, named for the late congressman and civil rights activist. His name is on the first of these ships. It's also in the fleet, so no word on whether that ship will be renamed. Congresswoman and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's from San Francisco, where Harvey Milk served on the Board of Supervisors before he was assassinated in 1978. She put out a statement calling the name change shameful and spiteful.
What do we know about the reasoning behind this?
You know, what, all we got from the Pentagon is a brief statement from spokesman Sean Parnell, who said this effort is, quote, reflective of the Commander-in-Chief's priorities, our nation's history, and the warrior ethos. Of course, these names are associated with the nation's history, and no sense of how this or has anything to do with the warrior ethos we keep hearing about from Pentagon leaders. Now, of course, this all follows Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's firing prominent black and female senior officers, questioning whether they received their posts for, because of merit or because of their race or gender. They included Air Force General C.Q. Brown, the second African-American to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first woman selected as the Navy's top officer. And remember, the Trump administration also set out to eliminate or restructure courses at the U.S. Naval Academy and West Point that had to do with racial, gender, or LGBTQ issues. Books with such topics are either removed from their libraries or are still under review.
Tom, I wonder, is it rare for the Navy to rename a ship?
You know, it really is. 2 years ago, the Navy renamed the USS Chancellorville and the USNS Maury based on a congressional commission's recommendation to remove names linked to the Confederacy. And the Maury became the USNS Marie Tharp, named after a pioneering female oceanographer. You know, I should also point out that there's a new aircraft carrier being planned, and it's called the USS Doris Miller, named after the Black Medal of Honor recipient who was a hero during the Pearl Harbor attack. The ship will get underway in 2029. No word on whether the Pentagon will seek a name change there.
So, as you say, the ship's name for Doris Miller, as well as John Lewis, they could remain potentially, right?
Yeah, we don't know. And this whole effort at removing references to what the administration calls either woke or DEI or divisive, it seems kind of haphazard. Earlier this year, the Pentagon pulled some links to achievements by military women, African-Americans, and Navajo code talkers from World War II, only to restore them after an outcry. The Pentagon also removed information about the Buffalo Soldiers, the black troops who fought out west in the 19th century. But get this, the Army's museum has a prominent display about them.
And NPR's Tom Bowman, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
In a world often ruled by screens and scrolling, we sometimes forget how nice it can be to just sit down with paper and pen to write an old-fashioned letter. Well, now we have a story about two unlikely pen pals, 17-year-old high schooler Michelle Liu from McLean, Virginia, and her 80-year-old friend Sue Miller.
I think you were three.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We met at our church, Whitechapel UMC, and we had a meeting room. I was kind of fearless. I would just meet people, and you were real shy. You were standing by your mom by the donut table. So that's really how we met.
That's Sue. We met when I was 3 at church, and she soon became like a grandma to me and my whole family. In the beginning, I drew her pictures, and we wrote letters to each other. When I was 9, my family moved from Texas to Washington, D.C., and we slowly became pen pals. We've been writing to each other consistently for the past 8 years, and I have 2 shoeboxes full of her letters. We don't talk much on the phone, but I wanted to call her up to let her know how much our pen pal friendship meant to me, and to also hear her side of our story.
Do you have the letters I sent to you over the years?
Oh, yes. Okay. I have a box.
Okay, shall we read some?
Sure. Dear Sue, how has your day been going? I just had my roller skate show. I had a lot of fun fishing with Bill. We were very happy when I caught a medium fish for the first time. We were all looking for the fish. Next up, piano show. Michelle.
Dear Michelle, happy birthday. This cute hedgehog or porcupine is loaded with a bouquet of flowers to help you celebrate being 12. If only we could ride on his back and surprise you for your birthday. We hope your day is as awesome as you are. Enjoy every minute, cherish your family and friends, and make beautiful memories. We certainly cherish so many memories with you and our Texas life.
I'm glad to be reminded of that.
Dear Michelle, happy birthday. You are a treasure. We treasure you and your friendship. We have made so many memories together. One of my favorite was the butter churning with Mina and Nicole.
When Nicole came.
Yes, yeah.
The butter. And I kept baking rolls. And I realized later, maybe that night, that we didn't actually have dinner. We just had rolls and butter and I think raspberries.
It was a good time.
It was a good time. I always remember that.
I want to end with why you inspire me. Letters, I feel like, are a wonderful way to have someone close, even when they are far away. It's kind of crazy to think about how many letters we have sent to each other these past 7 or 8 years since I moved to Washington, D.C., and I think through being pen pals, you have inspired me to stay connected with other people, regardless of how far 2 people can be. Sometimes it's hard to feel grounded in such a digital world we live in, but letters are such a tangible way to feel connected. And so I just wanted to thank you for the so many years of friendship, not only for me, but for our whole family.
And I thank you for all the letters, because I think what you just said is so very true. But I'll read this poem. What matters? 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car I drove, what kind of house I lived in, how much I had in my bank account, nor what my clothes looks like. But the world may be a little better because I was important in the life of a child. You inspire me.
Oh, thank you.
Unbelievably.
That story was originally produced by Michelle Liu with support from Wyatt Mays and Bridget Gansky for the On Our Minds podcast from the PBS News Student Reporting Labs.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. One of the most important figures in American gay literature has died. Edmund White helped usher in a wave of literary coming-out fiction with his 1982 novel, A Boy's Own Story. White died yesterday in New York City. NPR's Netta Ulaby has our remembrance and a warning. The story includes a discussion of sex and sexual situations.
Edmund White did not really mind getting labeled as a gay writer, as he told NPR in 2002.
You know, everything in America is niche marketing.
Maybe he was not as popular as mainstream peers like John Updike or Philip Roth.
But when you write for a minority group, you're sort of essential to them.
When A Boy's Own Story came out, he said, there were no openly gay movie stars or national politicians. Gay people could still lose jobs or kids because of their sexual orientation. White had already written a couple of well-received novels and co-wrote a book called The Joy of Gay Sex. For a boy's own story, he wanted to write something other gay men would recognize. He drew on his own well-off Midwestern childhood and adolescent sexuality.
I was lusting after boys my own age and even older men, and I was obsessed with that idea of having some sort of sex with older people.
That's White on WHYY's Fresh Air in 2006. His main character saves up to pay, in White's words, a hustler for sex. It is not, says White's biographer, Nicholas Radel, a sentimental effort to sanitize the feelings or actions of a gay teenager in the 1950s.
And that book famously ends with the young narrator having sex with the teacher and then turning him into the school authorities for smoking marijuana.
This book is part of a canonical trilogy of autobiographical novels among more than 30 novels and memoirs Edmund White wrote over his life.
I saw him do a reading in Paris, and he was reading from a memoir that he wrote.
Best-selling humorist David Sedaris talked about Edmund White on Fresh Air in 2013.
And I could not believe how frank he was. A lot of people in the audience were just horrified.
But Sedaris was impressed.
I really admired him, and he's such a good writer, too. And they were beautifully written. I mean, the writing was bigger than the sex.
White, like so many LGBTQ people of his generation, was transformed by the Stonewall Uprising in 1969. He was there, in New York, working as an editor for Time Life Books. He told NPR he walked by the bar with a friend when it was raided by the police.
And then pretty soon we had mixed in with the melee. Everybody remembers it as being terribly solemn because it was sort of like our Bastille Day. But the truth is, everybody was laughing. We'd been so oppressed for so long that the idea of claiming our rights seemed vaguely humorous to us.
Later, during the early years of the AIDS epidemic, Edmund White helped found the New York-based Gay Men's Health Crisis, the first social service group in the country for people living with HIV and AIDS. The writer had moved to Paris by the time he discovered he was HIV positive in 1985. He never expected to live as long as he did. White was part of a group of other gay writers, all men, who called themselves the Violet Quill. He told Fresh Air many of them died of AIDS.
I sometimes feel that I'm writing the books they might have written, or I'm expressing the things that otherwise would be lost. Or anyway, I do feel very grateful about having been given this extra lease on life.
Edmund White died of natural causes, according to his agent. He was 85 years old. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Kelly Girardi was the 90th woman to fly to space. She is also a mom who has been open about her struggles with infertility. On social media, where she has more than 2 million followers, she has created a community for people who have also experienced that sort of heartbreak. Danica Panetta has more on her journey.
As a payload specialist on a Virgin Galactic research flight in 2023, Kelly Girardi conducted in-flight experiments. In a viral video, she waves out the window of her spacecraft to her daughter, back on Earth.
Hi, Delta.
After struggling to get pregnant, Delta was Girardi's miracle baby.
We had Delta, and in the years that followed, we have had multiple miscarriages. So to date, I've been pregnant 5 times with only Delta as my child, and so it's been a rough journey.
Girardi struggles with secondary infertility. After years of trying to conceive again and a lot of research, Girardi and her family have turned to in vitro fertilization, or IVF. It's a process where eggs are extracted from the ovaries and fertilized in a lab, and Girardi shares every aspect of this process with her millions of followers.
There were so many highs and lows just within the process. The egg retrieval was my first time going through it, and I think I was just a little bit emotionally unprepared.
Only one viable embryo came from Girardi's first round of IVF, which resulted in a successful pregnancy that she wasn't afraid to celebrate, even in its early stages. In February, the day before her 36th birthday, Girardi attended one final ultrasound.
I went into my graduation appointment, or what was supposed to be my graduation, from my IVF clinic at that 9-week checkup. In that appointment, was just shattered to hear my doctor and the nurses in the room tell me that there was no heartbeat.
But Girardi's not giving up. After taking time to heal, she decided she was ready to try again. Girardi grew up as an only child, and she's always known that she wanted siblings for her daughter, Delta Victoria, who's named after the rocket science term Delta V, representing change and velocity.
Her name is, in the most loving way, a very deeply nerdy reference to, you know, our family's love of space and science. My mom loves the song Delta Dawn.
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by?
She did represent, you know, a major change in our life as a family and a beautiful new chapter that we had been so looking forward to.
Today, 3 faded white roses sit on Girardi's kitchen counter. They're embodiments of hope, each representing a viable embryo from her latest round of IVF.
Nothing is ever guaranteed in IVF. I'm not unaware that it is a distinct possibility that either the same thing happens again, which would be equally devastating, whatever it may be. I know the risks, and I know that nothing is a given, and yet I'm still allowing myself to exist in this level of hope and joy and enthusiasm and optimism.
Girardi has a second space mission scheduled for 2026. Those 3 embryos are set to be frozen, and when the time is right, she'll attempt another transfer. Danica Panetta, NPR News.
Before his death a little over a year ago in a Russian gulag, anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny reached millions of people through his YouTube channel. The Russian opposition leader moved to YouTube after he was banned from traditional TV, which the Kremlin controls. Now, thanks in part to Navalny's widow, Russians will again be able to watch the Navalny team's videos, interviews, and messages on TV, this time via satellite. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us more.
A new channel will begin broadcasting across Russia today. It's called Rossiya Budusheva, or Russia's Future, and its content will be provided by the late Alexei Navalny's organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation.
Hello.
Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, came to the headquarters of Reporters Without Borders in Paris for the launch. The press advocate is a partner in this joint venture. Navalnaya says getting their message out has been increasingly difficult since the war in Ukraine prompted the shuttering of independent media and draconian censorship.
We are trying to do all our best from YouTube, but still there are a lot of problems in YouTube, and it could be blocked every morning.
Not anymore. Now Russians will be able to watch the Foundation's latest anti-corruption videos on regular TV, where most people get their news. The channel will be beamed on a Hotbird satellite run by the French company Eutelsat. It covers a huge swath of Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Russia's future will be the 13th channel in a bouquet of free, independent Russian language programming called Svoboda, or Freedom Satellite. Jim Filipov is the project director.
So this project, we think, is a very important step because it brings the Navalny Group's great content, which is incredibly popular, to the Russian-speaking broadcast audience.
Best of all, he says, the Kremlin won't be able to shut it down.
It's not so simple to block satellite in general, and ours in particular. I can't go into details, but it hasn't been done yet.
Ruslan Shavadinov is editor-in-chief at Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation.
There are millions who don't agree with what's happening in Russia, and millions who are victims of Vladimir Putin's propaganda. And we, the team of Alexei Navalny, are committed to doing everything we can to fight this propaganda and show what's really going on.
Thibaut Brutin is the director general of Reporters Without Borders. When it comes to press freedom, his outfit ranks Russia 171st out of 180 countries.
What we're trying to do is to favor, little by little, this idea that the truth matters, that facts matter. I think the war that's raging in Ukraine is something that is showing the limits of also the Russian propaganda.
Russia's future hopes to attract new viewers, like those well-off Russians in the suburbs of big cities who are turned off and tuning out the Kremlin's narrative. Filipov again.
Now, for more than 20 years, the Russian public has been bombarded with anti-Western, anti-Ukrainian, anti-democratic, pro-authoritarian propaganda.
Navalnaya says Alexei would have relished this fight.
My husband, he was a great man, and I am sure that he would be very happy. Thank you so much.
Especially because Russia's future is launching on Navalny's birthday. He would have been 49. She says it's important to keep his legacy alive. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
From outdated technology like floppy disks still in use at many air traffic control towers to the recent telecom outages at Newark Airport, the U.S. air traffic system is in dire need of an overhaul. But fixing the busiest air traffic system in the world won't be cheap or easy.
Most of the telecommunication system is the very best technology of the 1980s.
Tune in tomorrow to All Things Considered to hear more. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.